Hello, this is Masao, indie game producer in Montreal, and your host for What Else Do You Do? Today, our guest is Ian Vaflore. Please introduce yourself and what you do.
Sure. Hey, my name is Ian Vaflore. I've worked full-time in the games industry for about 2.5, almost 3 years now. Been doing contract work prior to that, but I have done everything from copywriting to writing shout-outs to influencer relations, publishing, like being a publishing producer, being a producer QA within a very focused amount of time, mostly in the mobile and in the indie space over the last few years. But I think we're here to talk about what we do outside of that, right?
It's true. The podcast is called What Else Do You Do? So what else do you do?
People who know me also know that I have spent a good portion of my life putting on heavy foam rubber suit, monster suits, and wrestling in rings around the world as part of the performance art troupe Kaiju Big Battle.
That's super cool.
It's always something that I have to answer for when people add me on social media, or they'll like look at old pictures and be like, what is going on here? So
how did you get involved in this?
Yeah, it's kind of weird because I don't believe in fate, but it's also like being in the right place at the right time, and you keep seeing the same thing over and over again. Your paths are just going to cross. So I grew up as a stage kid, just playing the cello. I was a professional cellist. That's what I went to college for and everything. But I was in New York City.
Okay, hold on. So professional cellist is your starting point for Kaiju Yes. Big Battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did not expect that.
So being a classically trained musician and then going into wearing a giant soup can and dancing around on television. Yeah, it's a pretty straight path. But the TLDR is I have a background in music and performance. I've always been a creative person, and I spent a lot of time, a good portion of my early 20s in New York City. And there's a shop called Kid Robot that was near my partner's place of work. So I would go in there and like hang out and talk to the staff and everything. And one of the people that worked there would always hand me these flyers for this thing called Kaiju Big Battle. And just because they kind of looked at me and they're like, I think, you know, this kind of seems like this would be what you're into. And I would go to these shows, and this was pretty early on in the production's lifetime. If you're not familiar with Kaiju Big Battle, what's the best way we describe it? It's a spectacle. It's taking the visual language of professional wrestling and mixing it with Power Rangers. And we use that. It's originally started off as an art installation or a performance art piece from Randy and Dave Borden, based out of Boston. And it just kept just like the monsters themselves, they just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Their productions have gotten larger and larger. We've had appearances on television, MTV pilots, the Xbox 360 launch about 15, 16 years ago. I can't believe that was 15, 16 years ago now.
I started in the industry for the 360 launch. And the other day I was like, wait, this is my third generation of consoles, and felt extremely old.
My 360 and my fight stick are right next to me right now too. And Street Fighter 4 on it like pretty often. I keep it around for Marvel. But, I just like bombastic things hitting even bigger things. I think that's what it is. So Kaiju Big Battle's been around. It's a touring troupe. It's comprised of a combination of, you know, performance artists, visual artists, video artists, DJs, athletes, and professional wrestlers too. So it's had a really long history of folks who have gone on to some pretty impressive things in a lot of different industries under the suits. And that's kind of become part of the fun of seeing our shows when we would travel live, especially on WrestleMania weekends, because you just didn't know who was under the suit. And we would never, you know, to maintain that suspension of disbelief, we would never take the costumes off or anything like that. But astute viewers could be like, I think I know who that is just because of the way that they're moving. A lot of fun surprises have been after the shows as well. And, you know, with the advent of social media, that felt so weird saying that too. The advent of social media, like, it's a brand new thing. But, you know, like a lot of personalities in the games adjacent media space have been in the costumes over the last few years since I started booking the shows about 5 years ago. But to go back to what it was happening. So I was always aware of it. I was working as a DJ in New York City, and I would see those flyers everywhere. I started doing stand-up and improv comedy and like sketch comedy. I'm a UCB. I did UCB, like the whole thing there. And one of the shows that they did there was a comedy wrestling show called UCBW. That Pat Bear was the you know, one of the directors, if not like the sole guy behind. When I moved back to Philly, I was doing a fringe show that was inspired by the UCBW. And I had friends from the independent professional wrestling world as part of the cast. And from there, I was with another company for a while that had a lot of crossover with Kaiju Big Battle's fan base and audience. And as I spent more time doing more Kaiju shows like that, it just ended up becoming my main thing. So that's pretty much what it came down to. It was like, oh, like you're quasi athletic. You get what this is. You have an eye for it. You have a background in physical comedy. You know, it just all of a sudden just became the thing that I did over the weekends without even me realizing it. And I've been doing it for like, I think over a decade now. So
that's super cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I have over in my living room, I have a bunch of the suits just sitting in boxes right now. So, because we haven't been doing them for obvious reasons. So,
yeah. Actually, so our game studio is half game studio, half co-working space for comic book artists.
Oh, nice.
And one of the comic book artists is actually a indie pro wrestler as well. And, he's been bemoaning not being able to wrestle as well. So yeah, I definitely sympathize. It's,
I'm in group chats with a lot of my friends that I used to spend time on the road with, and it's good that in some promotions are practicing PPE and have figured out solutions to entertain their fan bases without putting people at risk. And I think that's super important right now. It's because almost all my hobbies have involved, you know, collaboration, like some kind of creative collaboration, or they've been in front of audiences, and that's been stifled. So it's finding new ways to pass the time that don't involve me getting drop kicked while wearing a 40-pound suit has been a challenge for the last year. So.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, at least it seems like the end of the tunnel is least visible.
Fingers crossed. But also, you know, I'm getting up there in years. I never thought I was going to be doing this for as long as I have. And it's I'm always honored when someone's like, oh, can you put on the suit, or like, we need you in a tag team match, or can you do a singles match or something like that? I'm like, you sure? Because I'm like the oldest dude on one of the oldest dudes on the roster. But yeah, but you can like do this really well. I'm like, all right. And then I'll get super nervous. I think this was the last show that we did before quarantine. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was in a tag match with a character. So I was on a tag match where it was myself, my tag team partner, and the suits that we were wearing are not really suits. They were just more like helmets. So we had a lot more mobility. And they were comedy characters. And then our opponents it was really just one opponent and an inanimate object. A giant stuffed teddy bear that you would win at, say, like a carnival. Yeah. So that's a regular exercise you would do, like we're called an invisible man match. So it was two people versus one opponent in an unwieldy bean-shaped suit and an invisible opponent. And we just made it work. And I remember thinking, like, how am I going to make this work? Because my tag partner has like really limited mobility because of years and years of messing up his knees. You know, I'm not a paragon of cardiovascular fitness. And the other guy can't see or hear anything. And then yeah, but we got 11 minutes out of it. It got people laughing. So.
11 minutes. That's a long match. Yeah.
Yeah. It's your brain is just kind of like tuned in. It's like, your brain is just kind of wired to make a meal out of like even the smallest of movements. And I learned that from from being a musician. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's funny because sometimes I teach a friend of mine string lessons over Zoom, and she plays a violin and I'm a cellist, but a lot of the same techniques and philosophies that I used to teach transfer from one to the other. So something, it might seem super trivial, but something like being mindful of your breathing. If you think you're, you know, if you think you're going so like super fast, you slow down. Really just making like playing to the back of the house. Are you a guitar? Are you a musician?
No, okay. I've fiddled around, but no, I don't play anything.
For some reason, I thought you were a guitarist. So I think everybody in our social circle.
Yeah, bass guitar. I'm around a lot of talented people, but.
But yeah, it's a lot of it was a lot of like taking my time and soaking it all in and you know, emoting a lot of, and I tend to look at the old Power Rangers shows for that, where it's a lot of gesticulation and like committing to the bit and pointing to communicate with your body when you're, because our characters don't talk. Mm-hmm. So how do we communicate that if you're wearing a full rubber mask? You know, it's like a lot of like pointing and shaking your head and like turning to the crowd and pointing at the thing you like, you know, that what they call crowd psychology. But yeah, it's a trip. I wish I could show you some of the,
it's know, true. Yeah. we're doing this over voice, which is possibly not the best medium to be talking about this because we have no visual aid, but I'll be sure to link some videos to the tweet when this goes out.
Yeah.
So, okay. So kind of to bring it back to the whole, the topic of this podcast, which is kind of game devs doing other stuff. What do you get out of this that you don't get out of working in the games industry?
Well, if you've never had several thousand people cheering for you, for doing something totally silly, like, I highly recommend that. That's to everybody listening. I remember taking a psychology class as an elective in college, and on our first day there, we had a questionnaire we had to fill out, and the question was, you know, you're given a piece of string, what do you do with it? And I had a totally silly answer. I mean, most people had like, oh, I'm going to tie it around my finger, or I'm going to thread a button, you know, and as a joke, I wrote, hold it up in front of 20,000 screaming fans. And that is a visceral rush that I've been fortunate enough to experience on multiple occasions. It's just a lot of fun. It's just this crazy adrenaline rush. I'm a bit of a adrenaline junkie. You know, I liked extreme sports. I've gone skydiving. I'm an avid snowboarder. So that's all part and parcel of it. I have yet to experience that in game dev. Maybe in esports. Maybe if I was a younger man and I actually was good at first person shooters, I would have gone into like professional Valorant. Yeah. Yeah.
Some of those live events have a lot of people.
I was like blown away at maybe it was the first or second TwitchCon where there was a League of Legends tournament that was being broadcasted there. So that was the first time that I had ever been in like got that big room feel from a gaming event, from an esports event. I had been to Evo in the past before it was in the Mandalay Bay. I forget, it was so long ago, but when it was still just in like the smaller convention rooms. But ever since then, I've been able to go to see Overwatch League live, and I'm just amazed at the level of production that esports tournaments have now. Like, it's nuts. Like, it rivals WWE events I've been to, you know, just with the lights and the sound and how professional the broadcast teams are, and just seeing thousands of passionate people. But even more so, I'll just glance at my phone and see who's watching the chat. It's like hundreds of thousands of people watching, like, you know, LCS or something like that. So that's
I still have a hard time kind of wrapping my mind around, like, I mean, even as someone who's worked in the games industry for almost 15 years, and, you know, like, this is my livelihood, but like, even then, the idea of like the number of people that watch, like, people who play games competitively or non-competitively, it's still kind of, you know, mind-boggling. Like the entirety of Twitch, like, I remember when Twitch came out and I was like, oh, I guess I get it. And then, and you look at what it is now and it's just...
I was with a digital marketing firm when Twitch transitioned from Justin TV to Twitch. And I remember just discussing that with my leadership team about the potential of it. And like, it was just bewildering to a lot of like old suits. Just like, you mean, you know, and it was funny because the CEO of the company who is a bit younger too, he just addressed everybody. He's like, replace every instance of esports with football and it will make perfect sense to you.
Well, see, that's the thing. Like, people are like, well, why would you want to watch somebody play video games like when you can play it? I'm like, well, people can play football too, you know?
I think that's funny too, because a lot of so in indie wrestling, a lot of the promoters and, you know, production teams have been operating with a certain, you know, with a certain mindset for, I'd say, about the last 25 years or so, where you film it and you sell it as a DVD, you know? So even prior to quarantine, when streaming platforms were becoming more and more prevalent, they had a hard time transitioning to that and seeing the value of it. Our production was pretty good about being on top of that. Like, we did TwitchCon. We just, because of the nature of our subject matter, like, we pull from tokusatsu to manga to a lot of video game references. Like, during our matches, we constantly have a soundtrack playing, and a lot of those songs are from like Persona, Mario, you know, like, so there's always these cultural touchstones in there. So we have an audience that's a little bit different than your typical wrestling fan. That's why we do really well, like Anime Boston and all these other types of conventions too. So it just kind of lent to it, like, but I've seen.
Well, it also has to do with business models, right? Like, yeah. Anime had a really hard time switching to like kind of a streaming service because like so much of their revenue was based on selling DVDs.
Yeah.
And that's conventional visual medium. So, you know, you would think like Netflix would have been an easy thing for them, but they had a hard time. There was a good 10 years where they really resisted.
I mean, I'm no lawyer, but I'm sure a lot of the rights management, because you had like your original publishers and then you had your Western
publishers. Yeah, I mean, the older stuff was obviously more complicated and still is. Like, you see a lot of like older anime that you don't see on streaming because everything's super complicated, like Macross and
Robotech.
Yeah, Robotech is like the Harmony Gold is the most notorious one for that. And I'm still kind of shocked that Amazon has managed to like untangle all of that. I guess they must have just thrown so much money at it.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
That stuff has always been really complicated.
Yeah.
You know, actually, talking about rights, completely unrelated, but did you know that everybody involved with Akira lost money except for, I think, Bandai?
Really?
Yeah, because basically, like, Ultima ran out of money, like, multiple times. Mm. And basically, they had to keep on getting more investors. Yeah. And the last investor to come in, I believe, was Bandai. And they were like, okay, well... and they kept on selling off different parts of the rights, and what they got was VCR rights. And at the time, they were like, "Whatever, nobody gives a shit," like, because that wasn't how they made anime made money back then.
Yeah,
you know, especially a feature film like that, they were expecting to make money primarily in theaters.
Yeah,
and in the end, like, it just became this like monstrosity, especially in the West, and just sold so many tapes that everybody else just took a bath, like, just like lost their shirt, except for the people who like came in and like put in a little bit of money to finish the movie, and they got the they got the home retail rights.
I was a hardcore tape trader back in the day. I had like 18th generation dubs of Cowboy Bebop and Dragon Ball GT and Evangelion. You know, like, you just get at event, not even like on the convention floor, just like you knew some guy, you talked to somebody in a concession line. It's like, yeah. Oh, the same thing with wrestling tapes too. It was the same exact way. Like the, I feel like that's kind of lost. It's that good and bad.
Pre-internet yeah, like, gray market stuff.
There was that secret underground feel to being into a really niche hobby. In the early 2000s, if you're into like indie wrestling, or if you're into even by the early 2000s when Toonami was running their anime blocks, there was still a lot of stuff that you could only get, you know.
Oh yeah, like there was, I mean, Japan produces so much anime, like, and yeah. I mean, nowadays with like so many streaming options, like majority of it is making it over here, but like back when it had to be on television, like they make like 100 shows a season or something, yeah. You know, like it's, there's no way that much is going to end up on television in the West, even at the peak of its.
It's funny because that's like, I'm still in contact and I'm still friends with people that I used to trade tapes with and used to import games with and everything. Somebody I worked with at my prior studio, we became friends because of an internet forum. Just, I think I found the forum just because I was looking for a place to import Ikaruga. And then I just, okay. It was like the only forum, the only message board where people were talking about it. It was Brandon Sheffield's Intercredit forum. So then that kind of became my place for gaming. And I've been longtime friends with a lot of people from that board, and even so much as becoming work colleagues with them. And we still kind of have that bond. And I think that's like that kind of goes into what I have with performing with Kaiju Big Battle too, is a lot of people that I traveled with on the road. Like we're all from that same kind of generation of like weird nerddom.
But like pre,
yeah,
it's like right at the cusp of internet becoming a medium in which you could actually distribute things, like right when high speed internet was kicking in.
Yeah. And on the other hand,
this relates to the last question I was going to ask you, which is like, how does all of this influence you as a game developer and someone who works in the industry?
Project management. That's being able to work with next to no budget, herding cats at times. Navigating a whole, you know, a slew of personalities and perspectives coming into a project, because it's booking a match, especially one where you can't really communicate with the person you're in the ring with. It's wholly collaborative, so we have to what we call the match prior to going in. Mm-hmm. We can't really talk to each other when we're in the ring. So being an active listener and an effective communicator, and I feel like I'm filling out a CV when I say stuff like that, but
but that stuff is really important. I mean, you do that wrong while you're wrestling, you'll get hurt. So
get hurt, yeah. It's funny because my outlet, since we haven't been doing live shows, has pretty much been running and playing like tabletop RPGs on Zoom, and it's a lot of the same mental exercises that we would go through when we would be booking a show, because we're telling a long form story. But also, you know, games are a narrative medium, and there's a lot of that as well. I it's funny, I was talking to a games journalism friend about it. He just in casual conversation was asking me the same question, and a lot of the now on the production end, project management's big, but then also in the act of playing games, I find I get a lot of the visceral, the visceral emotion and investment when I'm in the act of playing those games also. So there's a little bit of that dopamine hit, which is nice too. But yeah, I think like just being able to think on the fly, because nothing ever goes the way you want it to. as I've seen in my professional experience, I always have people asking.
Being able to roll those falls and then turn it into something.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I'll have people ask me, like, what's the SOP for doing this? And I'm like, every project is different. You can, you know, depending on the needs of your development team and you know what your timeline is. I'm no veteran, but I've seen this with a handful of projects in my limited experience so far. But yeah, it's a the nice thing about it is it's very cathartic. Even though we're not doing any live shows or performing in ring, I'm still very physically active, and that can, especially right now, being in quarantine and working from home, that is a really nice thing to be able to fall back on. You know, I can go for a run. I've always been keeping up with my personal fitness, so it's like, and go for a run. I was doing HIIT at a CrossFit school for a while before they shut down, and it's really helpful for helping me focus and just stay on task, because we're constantly handling multiple threads of communication, whether it's, you know, from the dev team, from marketing, from QA. It's all coming through, and you just need to find, like, it's taught me to focus on one thing at a time and kind of like mitigate the white noise. So
no, I totally agree. We have a pull-up bar in the office, and it's really the best thing I could have done, because like every time I kind of feel like sluggish and kind of distracted, I just go and do a bunch of pull-ups and I come back to my desk and I'm like, yeah, I can do this, you know. I can get even back on task.
Simple, yeah, like even something as simple as going for a walk. I did that right before we jumped on a call together too. That's always helped. A lot of times my team and I, we would just be like, okay, we're really frazzled about things. Let's just go for a walk around the building, you know, like outside, just do it, walk to the CVS, walk back, you know, talk, let's walk and talk and just try to like clear our thoughts and then get back on task when we get back into the office. And that's helped a whole lot. I kind of miss it. Not seeing the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis, but yeah, like you said, like hopefully we'll be getting out of that, or we'll be coming out on the other end of that soon. Yeah, it's stopping and doing 50 squats or something if you're frazzled because you're reading too many emails. That might be a lifesaver.
No, so. I stand by that. I stand by that. Okay, so one last question, even though I think I already said that the last question was going to be the last question, but what's something that you would like people to know about Kaiju Big Battle that they wouldn't know unless they were involved in it?
Yeah, literally everything we could possibly think of going wrong before a show goes wrong. That's, yet somehow we're all a giant bundle of nerves before we run out from the entryway, like the entryway, even moments before the fans are let in. But it means a whole lot to us that everybody's having a good time. Like once we see everybody in the audience having a good time and enjoying themselves, it's like, oh, well, I guess that wasn't really that big of a problem anyway, because, you know, they didn't know that the ring showed up 18 minutes before the fans were let in. You know, like they didn't know that we forgot, you know, our extra small t-shirts. It's okay. Like, you know, nobody's mad. Like, at the end of the day, nobody's super mad that the wrong song was played during the match. Like, oh man, I missed that DDT. It's okay. Everyone's still laughing. Okay. I think that, you know what it is? It's like problems are much bigger in our own heads than they are in real life. You know, like a lot of things this is a personal thing. It's like I'll harp on things, and at the end of the day, it's like, oh, it really wasn't that big of a deal. You know, once I'm given more perspective about it, I'm beating myself up for something that I don't have control over, or I do have full agency over. I just need to like take a step back and look at it in context of everything else that's going on, if I just talk to the other people that are with me. So.
Well, that was really awesome. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And that was really great. I really enjoyed that.
Thanks, bud. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you too. It's.
But yeah, I think we did it. I think that's it. Thank you very much for. And I'll see you around gig, I guess.
Thanks, bud. Yeah, I'll talk to you soon.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening, and thank you to Dave Wallace for providing the music for the beginning of the episode. And thank you to Trez for creating the logo for our podcast. Join us again next week for another episode of What Else Do You Do? Bye.